Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the discussion portion of What's Wrong with Our Schools, part of Volume 6 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Milton Friedman is joined by other distinguished guests at the University of Chicago to discuss some of the ideas presented in the documentary segment of What's Wrong with Our Schools. Listen now and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
The distinguished guests tonight are all intimately concerned with the world of education. So let's find out how they react to Friedman's analysis.
I think it's very foolish to throw out something that you've got and that has some shortcomings, but is very, very good in order to try out someone's pet ideas.
Well, before we ask Milton to reply to that, let's get other views on that same quotation. Market competition is the surest way to improve the quality and promote innovation in education. John Coons.
Well, of course, there's enormous evidence that that is exactly right. And we see it in the case in California that I observe every day of low-income children whose families are making great sacrifices to go to schools that operate at a third of the cost of public education and are turning out kids who are performing and are learning and achieving at very high levels. On the other hand, I wouldn't want to suggest that that unlimited competition is the answer to every problem. And indeed, the whole definition of competition is very ambiguous. Seems to me that if one is truly interested in liberty, which I think is the ultimate value that Milton Friedman talks about, one has to be very careful how he structures the kinds of subsidies that are proposed for education so that you do not wind up with the poor in one kind of school and the rich all in the other, and very little liberty for low-income people left over, which is what I think he has in mind. I don't think he has that result in mind. He has the hope in mind of liberty, but that it's going to need a certain kind of tailoring before it works that way.
I think your remarks about free competition are very unfair for a very simple reason. You cannot have free competition where one group of schools must accept every single student who comes along, no matter what his physical or emotional handicaps or other problems. Whereas the very essence of a private school and your voucher school is that they're going to be able to keep out the students, and the finest schools that you saw in that film were schools that deliberately kept out the most difficult students. Of course you can have a wonderful school if you pick students whose parents are so highly motivated that they're willing to spend more money and willing to go out of their way to do something like that. Now, the public schools have to take the handicap, must provide bilingual education, must engage in busing or other programs in terms of integration, must do all of these things, whereas the private school can come along and say, well, if your child has no problems, you know what we can do? We can offer you a school where you don't have to sit next to a child with these other problems. We're going to put you next to other children who are advantaged.
I think in the real world, there is no competition between private schools and public schools, because private schools, especially parochial schools, do not have to comply with federal and state mandates and constitutional limitations and things of that sort.
Dr. Andrig.
I think the part of the film that speaks to the greater parental involvement, I agree with very enthusiastically. However, I think the solution is the wrong solution for the problem that you identify. I think the role of public education in a democracy is not akin to that of the marketplace. The purpose for the common school is not the same as the purpose for the marketplace. We are trying in our public schools to create a democracy, to create an educated electorate. If you're going to do that, you have to have the common school.
How far do you accept his analysis of the present condition of the public education system? A pretty drastic analysis.
Well, I think he's established three straw men that I think have to be challenged, with all respect, Professor Friedman. The first is that there is a profession of educators out there which is run amok. We have the most decentralized system in the world in American education. 16,000 school districts that are governed not by the profession, but by elected citizen representatives, most of whom are parents. Secondly, you long, as I would, for the good old days of the one-room school in Vermont. That school served a small proportion of the youngsters for a short period of time, and those days will never come back. Third, you use as an example of American education a troubled high school in an urban center.
In my bailiwick,
which is not typical of where the American student goes to school, first of all, and secondly, is not typical of the city of Boston. And I do think it's important to point out that that particular school, at the time that you took the filming there, or your production crew did, was in the middle of a desegregation process that was not anywhere remarked about in the film. So it was not a typical example either of education in America or of education in Boston.
The one unsurprising thing about these comments is that all of the opposition to allowing the market work comes from people who have a very strong vested interest in the present public school system. I am not proposing, we are not proposing to destroy the public school system. We are only asking that the public school system should be free to compete, should be open to competition. If it is really as good as you people make it out to be, it has nothing to worry about. Now, in terms of your comment, of course there's a great deal of decentralization. We showed a very good school in this film as well as a very bad school. There are many good schools. And the more decentralized the control, in my opinion, the more satisfactory is the schooling. The real problem is concentrated in those areas where decentralization has broken down, where you have moved to much greater centralization, much greater control. And the main trouble areas are in the large cities. That's why we picked that school to show. In response to the question of the excellence of the schooling that's coming, I think there is nobody who can question the declining SAT scores, the declining scores on exams, the declining performance in the schools, the fact that there is widespread dissatisfaction, that many schools, not all schools, some schools in urban areas are more accurately described as centers to keep people off the street than as educational institutions.
When you have a free market, there are dangers that go along with that market. Now, we know that there are people, in our society who buy consumers reports, and there are people who do a great deal of research before they buy something, and there are other people who are taken in by the crass commercials and an instant appeal to give them some sort of a gimmick with a thing. And I think that the evidence is pretty clear that if you take middle class and wealthier families, they're going to do a good deal of research. They may very well be able to invest some additional money of their own to take some inconvenience. And if you have an open system of this sort, it may very well be that the poorest parents are going to have to take what is most convenient for them, what is going to fit in with their own work schedules, what is not going to require additional sums of money. And there is no doubt in my mind that you set up a system of a free choice of this sort, you're going to end up with the poor in one set of schools of their own on the basis of a good deal of gimmicks that will be offered.
Right. They're ignorant.
Excuse me, Mr. Shanker, I want to ask you one question. How do you explain the fact that there is no area of the free market, no area of the private market, in which the poor people who live in the ghettos of our major cities are as disadvantaged as they are with respect to the kind of schooling they can get? I want you to name me any aspect of the private market. They're not as disadvantaged in the kind of supermarkets they can go to. They're not as disadvantaged even in the kind of housing they can occupy as they are in respect of the kind of schooling their children can go to.
What's your evidence for that? I don't think you have any evidence for that.
They're trying to get out.
They're trying desperately to get out. Families who have very low incomes are trying to get into the parochial schools
exactly.
that you're talking about.
And
they
they're, trying to, get, and they're trying
religion.
To get out of the slums, and they're trying to get into different neighborhoods.
They're doing better on that. They're doing better on that. And instead, in a free choice system, you would have more heterogeneous schools, in my opinion, far less segregation by social and economic class than you now have. It so happens that right now, the parochial schools are the only alternative really available to low-income people.
Do they and take the all the children that, who want to get in?
The reason for that is that it's very hard to sell something when other people are giving it away. Anybody who wants to send his child to a non-public school has to pay twice for it, once in the form of taxes and once in the form of tuition. Under the kind of voucher scheme that Jack Koons and I would support, that difficulty would be eliminated. You would now have a situation in which the low-income people would have the kind of bargaining power, the kind of possibility of choice, that those of us who are in the upper income groups have had all along.
Jack Koons, I want you to come in now. I know you're in principle advocating the voucher system. Could you give us the case as you see it? I know you've got your differences with Milton on it, but let's have the case.
Now, what we are doing in California is establishing a form of change, possible change, proposing a change, in which lower income people will get information along with the opportunity to go to any school of their choice and transportation to get there. Of course they need information. Anybody needs information in a market. And they need information from independent sources, not from the schools themselves. And that's the way the initiative is designed, to come from independent sources. Now, we believe that ordinary people can make the best judgments for their children about where they should go if they're given good professional advice. And it also helps teachers because they can, for the first time, be professionals. They can act like real professionals because they don't have a captive audience. They don't dominate their client. They respect their client and they deal with them on the basis of contract. What could be better for teachers and for the first time to become people who are dealing in a democratic and respectful way with clientele instead of with captives?
I am concerned that voucher systems will lead towards havens for white flight, will lead towards a dual school system in the sense that you have one school system operating under one set of rules, the other school system, the public school system, operating under carefully articulated educational policy in any given state.
In fact, that's why I think in Los Angeles County, the movement to private schools last year was less, a smaller percentage than in the statewide pattern.
You may have 5 or 10% of the students who have very severe problems and come from families with very severe problems. And those students take up 95% of the time of the teachers and the administrators, and the other children aren't getting an education. Now, you're going to set up your voucher school. Are your voucher schools going to accept these tough
you
children?
You bet they are.
Well, they accept these.
And those kids,
if they accept those
question.
If they accept those children, I'll tell you what's going to happen.
Okay, you tell me, and then I'll tell you.
What's going to happen is that the parents of all the other children are going to move right out and go to another school because ultimately you're going to have to deal with hardcore problems.
John Coons.
Whether it's in a private school or whether it's in a public school.
In other words, that kid isn't tough in the school that he's in because he's stuck there. He's just a rotten, tough kid.
You can't imagine
a situation where if he were given choice and allowed to go to a school that he liked and to which he would connect emotionally, that he would no longer be a troublemaker, but that he would like to stay in a place where he has chosen and would therefore do what is necessary to stay there and to learn.
You know, I don't think you've been near schools or classrooms
Thanks
for a heck
a lot.
Of a long time.
I happen to have 5 kids who've done a lot of time in public and private schools, both.
We're not talking about the problems that your children don't have.
That's around the table.
I have to get to this point because I think it's a very crucial one. I don't think Mr. Shanker is saying that you should never use a doctor if you have cancer who hasn't himself had cancer. Let's get rid of the idea that the only people who are competent to judge about whether a school is good or bad is a parent who at the moment has children in that school. The plain fact is that children are not born troublemakers. They do not emerge from the womb. Some of them do, of course, but most of them do not. Most of the cases of the tough kids in the schools you're talking about are tough kids because they're lousy schools. Because the schools do not evoke their interest, because the school does not attack.
You're dead
give
wrong.
Them choice.
You're
give
dead.
Them choice.
Now, wait a minute. I want Greg Anring on this one. Milton,
it's not often I have a chance to tell a professor he's wrong, but with all respect, Professor, the problems that you see in the urban schools of this country are not problems of the schools. They're problems of poverty. And they're problems of what do you do when, for demographic and sociological and economic reasons in a country like ours, you begin to concentrate those people who are poor in the inner and older parts of the cities of our country. That's when the problem comes. And it's not just a problem of schools. It's a problem of housing, of jobs, of medical care, of social services. And the same problems crop up. And to say that the answer to that is take one part of that element and say, just set up a competitive marketplace, is not dealing with the problem. The problem is the problem of poverty.
We've dealt with the problem.
I am struck with the anomaly. The anomaly that arises out of any of this discussion of the voucher system. The facts are that government support, call it subventions, call it direct aid, call it grants and aid, call it vouchers, call it anything, will lead ultimately to government control of the private schools, thus undercutting the alternative nature of private schooling and hurting it at its very source.
You ought to look at our initiative. With that on the higher education level, you had the whole GI Bill. Did the GI Bill really lead fundamentally to control of all the schools? There's a fundamental difference between government giving money to an institution, to a school, that does lead to control directly, and government giving money to people to use. The food stamps don't determine what people buy with their food stamps. They may be a good or a bad program. That's not my point. My point is that don't underestimate the crucial difference between making money available to parents to spend as they choose to exercise their judgment and making money available to institutions like schools which they spend subject to all the conflicts which they have with school teachers and others.
You use Dartmouth as an example, and I think the concerns that I have about the voucher systems, the various ones proposed, is not with the one applicant that can get accepted to Dartmouth, but with the eight applicants that don't get accepted to Dartmouth. What's going to happen to that group of youngsters? You can have a situation in the free marketplace where everybody takes the cream, but what about the youngster that doesn't measure up? What about the youngster that's a risk? It seems to me that some of the greatest leaders of this country were people that would have been rejected by Dartmouth and most of the Ivy League schools.
Let's get other views on this, then we'll come back to you.
I just want to comment, because I have to comment on two points, the one he made earlier about poverty and this one. But on this one, Dartmouth is one of the best examples of the private schools. UCLA is one of the best examples of the state schools. That's why we chose them. There are many other private schools which are not as selective and are available to people who can't make the Dartmouth cut. There are many other public schools, state schools, that are less advanced than UCLA and the California system. There are all sorts of grades of schools. But the difference between the two is the same at lower levels. Now, I do want to make one comment going back to your poverty thing. And that is that, first of all, other programs in this series deal with the issues you've raised. But second, do not underestimate the role which bad schooling provided by our present governmental mechanism has played in creating poverty. It's been a major source, particularly among black and white teenagers coming up to the slums. It's been a major source of their difficulties of getting out of the trap of poverty. So it's not a one-way relation between poverty and the schools. The schools have themselves bear a great deal of responsibility.
The reason the schools bear it, and it isn't the schools directly, it's that we don't put enough resources in for children who need special and additional help because they are not getting it in their homes, or they're not getting the same sort of support in home and community as middle-class kids do. And then we wait until the child is 16 or 17 and drops out, and then we provide a youth employment program for them where we spend between $5,000 and $10,000 to try to undo what could have been undone in the first, second, or third grade if we had a decent investment in the public schools.
I have never yet known anybody who was trying to defend a government program who didn't say all its evils came from the fact that it wasn't big enough. Now, the fact is,
but you think the children with problems need the same amount of education and the same amount of investment as children who don't have special problems?
I just want to tell you some facts. The number of students in schools has been going down. The total expenditures on schools, allowance being made for inflation, after allowing for inflation, has been going up. The number of pupils has been going down. The number of teachers have been going up, and by all accounts, the quality has been going
down. Milton, actually, just a minute.
I want to hold you back for a moment, Mr. Shanker.
We got on to higher education, and I don't want to leave it without getting the rest of Milton's thoughts on it. In particular, you seem to be coming to say at the end of the film that the right answer is a system of realistic loans, where people therefore know what it's costing, rather than trying to hold down college fees and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that the higher education is the most disgraceful example on the record. I know of no governmental program that seems to me is so unfair and disgraceful in imposing costs on low-income people to benefit high-income people. We in the upper and middle-income classes have conned the poor in this country to supporting our children in going through college and university, and we scream to the treetops about how disinterested and how public-spirited we are. We ought to have a system under which everybody who wants to go to college can go there. He has to pay his own way, either now or later on. And the schemes I have in mind, if we developed them more fully, and as I have in other contexts and other areas, are along the line of the Educational Opportunity Bank that Professor Zacharias of MIT and a commission appointed by President Johnson came up with as a way of enabling students to finance their own higher education without facing the problem you raised of ending up with a large dollar debt.
I do think that,
Dr. Henrich,
with some trepidation with the professor, I raised a question of taxation. That is that I agree that we need better loan systems than we have. But as I understand the American tax system in general, as a generality, it is a graduated system.
Absolutely.
It is an equalizing system. And to reach the conclusion that
it is not. It's on paper. But you got to look at the facts.
Yeah. Well, yeah. What I'm trying, it is a system which the wealthier get, or the middle class gets taxed more than somebody who's making a lesser salary. To say then that the poor are funding public higher education, where middle class youngsters, and by the way, a lot of poor youngsters go as well, it doesn't fit with my understanding, at least, of the tax system. Now, I'm not an economist, I admit it.
Well, it turns out that there have been some very careful studies made of exactly what you're describing. There's one particularly careful one for California.
Vice Brad, right?
There's one for Florida. These show, it's not a minor item, that if you take the total receipts from expenditures on higher educations going to the lower classes and the total taxes they pay that are used for higher education, The lower classes are paying more than they're getting, and the higher classes are getting more than they are paying for. Now, beneficiary of this subsidy. I'm one of the worst cases on record. I went to a state school, Rutgers University. I went on a state scholarship. The poor suckers in the state of New Jersey paid for my going to college. I personally think that was a good thing. There are many people who have different opinions about that. I don't see any reason whatsoever I shouldn't have been required to pay back that money. Individuals pursuing their separate individual interests also provide public benefits. Of course, I think that the public benefited from my getting an education, but the primary beneficiary was me. I was the one who got the benefit from it. I was the one who had the higher income.
No, you benefited.
I know I benefited. I don't know about the problem.
I'd like others of you to react, though, to the idea of moving from state education at the higher level, which is based upon low fees in state universities, in favor of a loan system. This is hotly debated in many other countries, too. What's your own feeling about that?
Being a tenured professor at a state university, I suppose you really put me on the spot. I hope none of my friends are listening, but I tend to agree in general with Milton Friedman that we ought to find a way to open up to all classes, all income classes, the kinds of opportunities that the middle class have at my university. And I cannot give you, we don't have time to go through all of the kinds of ways in which we would do it, but I would, just personally, it seems to me we ought to let people come free at the beginning and pay it back out of their income over their lifespan. So if they make a lot of money, they pay back a lot of money. Perhaps we can run the whole university in the future on their success to which we contributed with our teaching. And if they don't make any money, they don't pay anything back, and that's okay, too.
And you ought to share in the losses if they
don't. Exactly.
I can't think of anything that would frighten poor people more than the thought at the end of the 4 years or 6 or 7 or 8 years of higher education, they have this albatross around their neck.
Only if they're rich.
Only
if they become rich.
There's no albatross. Would you say the same thing about people who start businesses? You've got millions of people in this country who start private businesses every year. Many of them lose money. Many of them make money. Would you say that nobody is going to start a business because he might end up with an albatross? You want to let people decide that for themselves. What I really want to know is a very different thing. How do you justify taxing the people in Watts to send the children from Beverly Hills to college? That's a demagogic statement, but it happens to be empirically a correct statement. How do you justify it?
Well, I don't know how we justify taxing all the people of this country to send the GIs under the GI Bill, but I'm very grateful that we did it. I don't know what this country would have done in the post-war period without a huge number of educated people in a whole bunch of fields that opened up after that. And I doubt very much that the GIs would have come back at the age that they were and everything else and would have decided that now they're going to take out loans to go to college. Yes, they were poor, and they went because they had government support to go and because basically there were a lot of state-supported low-tuition schools. And if you didn't have the state schools and if you didn't have the government support, we would have been without those people, and I don't know what would have happened our strength or to our economy without that.
The history of this country goes back a little bit before 1945. It goes back 200 years. State schools, universities, were a minor part of the total higher educational system for a long time. That educational system did generate a great many educated and schooled people, a great many people who made great contributions to this country.
What percentage of people went to college before World War II?
The percentage that was going to college was going up and rising. You know, let me tell you another statistic. I hate to introduce statistics, but let me tell you one more thing. Do you know that the percentage of the students at private universities who come from low-income classes is higher than the percentage of students at state universities, at government universities that come from the lowest income classes?
Yes, they're there with government assistance.
Most cases
they're there with government assistance, which in many cases favors the privates as against the public schools.
In most cases, private scholarships that have been contributed by
some
people,
of them,
which
some
is
of
all
them,
to
yes.
the good.
Dr. Henry,
we come back to the point that I tried to make earlier with Dartmouth. The reason the public higher education system developed, the reason that you have the UCLAs and others is not simply that government went amok or bureaucrats went that way, but because eight of those students were not getting into Dartmouth and there was not a place for them, and it was public higher education that opened up its doors to those students. Those are the youngsters that now have an opportunity they wouldn't have had before. I think on the issue of loans, that it's as with all complex human tasks, it's not an either-or situation. You need a mix of strategies. I think you need a mix of strategies on the issue of alternatives for youngsters in schools. I think you can have, as indeed you do have, alternatives within public school systems. I think you can have alternatives within schools. I think you can have competition through open enrollment kinds of arrangements. I am fearful, however, always, for those eight youngsters that can't get in to something which is basically selective and exclusive. If you can assure us that those eight youngsters all will be provided with equal attention, equal opportunity, and equal rights, then I would begin to be more interested in the alternative.
But I want to suggest to you that we're not proposing, neither Jack Coons nor I, to dismantle anything. We're only saying put up or shut up. Either show that you can produce the kind of education people are willing to go and get, or reduce your size, go out of business. We are only proposing that there be a wider range of alternatives. Now, it is not true. Let me put a different point to you. There are a small minority of people who are problems. Is it desirable to impose a straitjacket on 100% of the people or 90% of the people in order to provide special assistance or special help to 4 or 5 or 10% of the people? Not at all. I think that there's a big difference between two kinds of systems. One kind of system in which the great bulk of parents have effective freedom to choose the kind of schools their children go to, whether at the lower or the higher level. And there are programs and provision for a small minority. That's one kind of a system. That isn't what we have now. What people in the public school system, people like yourself, do, they do not want to give up the monopoly of the public school system any more than the post office wants to give up the monopoly of delivering mail.
I think you attribute the monopoly desire to the bureaucrat. And I don't think that's right. The concern of the public school is for being sure that every youngster in this country gets access to a public education.
Excuse me. You have had an attempt to introduce voucher experiments around the country. Every one of those attempts, as at Alum Rock and elsewhere, has been prevented by the opposition of the educational bureaucracy.
Oh, but no, you can't. That's a glittering generality.
That was true in Connecticut.
Well, it's not true
in Alum Rock, because Alum Rock was not what you might call a voucher system. It was a kind of a system of free choice within public schools. All right. And whereas one school did better in its scores, others did worse. And when you measured the whole system, when it was all over, the scores were exactly the same as they were before, except that some students had moved to other schools and the grades were better in one school as against another. We do very strongly oppose a voucher system which will end up with public schools being abandoned and thereby destroyed largely. They will become the schools for those who can't get in anywhere else or who are expelled elsewhere.
Because if you compel
public schools to educate all children, including the most difficult, and if you have other schools...
It isn't compelling public schools. It's compelling parents.
No, it's public schools. The public school cannot say to a parent, your child is very difficult, your child throws things, your child screams and yells, your child takes all the attention of the teacher, therefore get out and go find a private school. On the other hand, you have hundreds of private schools in this country where when they get a very disturbed child, out that child goes, and where does that child go? The public schools must take them.
But look at the
And that's what we have. We have one system of schools which cream and which throw out the most difficult. You know, it would be like a hospital throwing out all the sick patients and keeping the healthy ones.
Well, there we leave this week's discussion.
I hope
you'll join us for the next episode of Free to Choose.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.